Let me begin by saying something about my own experience with St. Thérèse. We had a statue of her at home, and it was one of these statues that had this glass over it. This was popular at one time. It was a fairly high statue. And it was a statue which I didn't exactly like, because I felt she looked a little bit sugary to me. No, for a young girl, I'm sure it would have been quite attractive. But for me, and I always liked roses, by the way, that had nothing to do with it, I just had thought, well, you know, there's the great Saint Teresa. Great Saint Teresa. There was a woman for you. And in many ways, of course, that's true when you consider what she did and all. And I had already read her life in the editions that were available at that time. That is the autobiography, I should say. There were no critical editions then that were done from the French text to the English. And somehow there were just a lot of aspects that I just wasn't entirely comfortable about. And I suspected, I said, I wonder if this is the real saint. So about, I would say it was 13, 14 years ago, I decided to go on my own and make a retreat in Lisieux, where I stayed in the house of the Community of the Beatitudes, which was right behind the foyer where the ITI stayed, I think it was exactly 5 years ago. And that allowed a lot of conversations about St. Thérèse, but it also allowed me to read for the first time the critical edition of her autobiography, and which had only been published in French starting in 1956 and a little after that. It wasn't very well spread at that time, and it was translated much later. So, and after this week, of course, with the retreat, there's a lot of prayer, and it's not simply the reading. But I remember being in the Basilica in Lisieux, and realizing, I said, you know, there are saints, and then there are great saints, and Saint Thérèse is one of these. It's very, very hard for me to think that I could do justice to her in this period of time. It's very hard. You will probably go away somewhat dissatisfied. You may learn, of course, something, but I don't know how you could possibly do justice to her in an hour. I don't think it's possible. So I'll be emphasizing some things and not emphasizing some others. So please forgive me when I say that. In order to understand what happened to me personally, that is to say how I rediscovered her, seeing the original manuscripts, you have to realize that the three manuscripts of her autobiography were entrusted to her sister Pauline, Sister Agnes, or Mother Agnes, to correct and to put into chapters, because they weren't written in chapter form. And Thérèse was writing this at a time when she was sick, and she never really finished school, so there were probably spelling mistakes and things like this in there. But, of course, it's one thing to correct spelling mistakes before publication and grammatical errors, you know, maybe a comma wasn't here or something. But it's another thing to omit sections and to omit sentences and to add some things. And that's what her sister did. And if you ask how many corrections did Sister Agnes or Mother Agnes make to her work, which after all is not that long, the one who actually did the critical edition of her work, Père François de Saint-Marie, in 1956, counted 7,000 corrections. 7,000. Now, what were the things omitted? I'm not going to say, you know, her spelling and things like that doesn't regard. I hope somebody would correct mine as well. But what did she admit? Most of the passages where she doubted God's existence, this was part of her dark night of the soul, are eliminated. You're not going to get much of an impression of that in reading the translations based on the manuscript of Mother Agnes. Now, she actually in the original manuscripts, called the atheist of her times, her brothers and sisters, and she fantasizes dining with them because she understood what they thought. In general, Sister Agnes, Mother Agnes, eliminated from the manuscript all expressions and incidents that didn't fit in with the concept of what a saint was in the late 19th century. So that has to be kept in mind. There was a certain concept there of how a saint was supposed to behave and what she was supposed to do, or he was supposed to do. And in Saint Therese, in her writing, actually complains about the biographies of saints written at the time, because she said, that sounds like all of the sisters were going around like this all the time, and there was no, you know, joy, no saint. And if you think about how many statues of saints are, do you know, where the saint is smiling? I mean, I would remember going into the Basilica in Verona there and seeing Saint Zeno with his big grin on his face, and I was a bit taken back, and I said, this is a saint? Saints are supposed to be, you know, not like that. But, of course, the concept of the 19th century saint really was that, and I would say that some of the things that Mother Agnes omitted, we would find charming and fully human today, and we would say, oh, thank God, she's more like me than I thought. She didn't go around all the time like that. So let me give you a couple of examples of what was left out. The first is her act of self-offering, which she made at her profession. So this is what she really said. Jesus, make that I may save many souls, and that today there may not be a single one damned, and that all the souls in purgatory may be saved. Jesus, forgive me if I say things I ought not to say. I only want to give you joy and to console you. Mother Agnes, that's not what a saint should say. I find it very touching. No problem in a saint saying that. Another example was during the later years, well, actually probably in the last year before she actually died of her tuberculosis. And she was then writing as much as she could to finish, because we knew, the doctors knew, the chances were she was going to die fairly soon. And so she writes, as soon as I start picking up my pen, there is a good sister who passes by, a hay fork on her shoulder. She thinks she is entertaining me a little when she starts chatting. Hay, ducks, chickens, doctor's visits, all come up for discussion. Truth to tell, this does not last long, but then there is not only one charitable good sister, but suddenly another haymaker deposits some flowers on my knees, thinking perhaps they will inspire poetic thoughts. But as I am not looking for those at the moment, I had rather that the flowers were still waving to and fro on their stems in the garden. Now, that is a perfectly human response. She's trying to get the work done. After all, she was under obedience to write. It's not as if she decided herself. She was under obedience to write. And the sisters, and she really knew that they were well-meaning. There's no criticism. But she was annoyed. She was annoyed. She's trying to get this done. She's feeling sick. And in many ways, I would say, what you see in the original manuscripts is a far more humorous saint than often gets presented. And the last example may be of comfort to those of you who have trouble concentrating on the mysteries of the Rosary. I am ashamed to confess it, but the recitation of the Rosary costs me more than to use an instrument of penance. I feel I am saying it so badly. Try as I may to make myself meditate on the mysteries, I never manage to fix my thoughts on them. That's from a saint. Mother Agnes made sure that she put her blue pen through that one as that was censored. Now, not having access to what Teresa really wrote led to false conclusions about her mental and spiritual health, as exhibited, for example, in the book of the priest Etienne Robault, Two Portraits of Saint Therese, which was written in 1955. For him, he writes about Saint Therese as a severe neurotic all of her life. And he cites quite rightly that her confessor, Père Pichon, assured her solemnly that she had never committed a mortal sin in her life. This is after she had made a general confession. But Robo's conclusion was, I quote, "She seems to have taken it simply as a tribute to her exceptional perfection." End of quote. But this is a false conclusion. But he would not have drawn that conclusion if he had been able to see what was in the original text, blue-penciled by Mother Agnes. For after assuring her that she had never committed a mortal sin in her life, her confessor adds, "Thank God for what he has done for you. For if he would abandon you, instead of being a little angel, you would become a little devil." And Teresa's response was, "I did not find it difficult to believe that. I realized how weak and imperfect I was." And that's the real Saint Therese, not the Saint Therese that thought in any way that she had reached exceptional perfection because of not having committed a mortal sin. What Mother Agnes did with the writings, to a certain extent, Céline, her sister, did with photography. When Céline entered the Carmel after the death of the sister's father, she was allowed to bring her camera with her and all of the developing equipment and so forth. And if you remember, the cameras at those times were gigantic. You know, this is not a small little thing that you can shoot at any time. And she took a good number of pictures during the those years that right before Therese died, including the one of Saint Therese as Joan of Arc here. Joan of Arc was Therese's favorite woman saint, and she wrote 8 plays, 2 of them about Joan of Arc, and she made sure that she played the role of Joan of Arc. And so that's what you see here. There's another nice picture of her with sort of a flame in back of her. Actually, the curtain caught on fire and she almost got burned, but that's beside the point. In any case, what Céline did was she improved the pictures, she improved the photographs. As you can, in other words, this thing of touching up photographs is not an invention of our own time. Of course, it's a lot easier to do today than it was then. But she did that, and so this round and lively face with a twinkle in her eye that you may see in some of her childhood pictures disappears. She has now an oval face, which she never had, and she looks a little bit more serious, And in other words, she became what Cecile thought she should look like to be accepted as a saint. And I'm sorry to disillusion you, but the large photograph that we have of her at the top of Stiga 2 is not the way she looked. What can I say? It doesn't make her less of a saint, but it's not the way she really looked. So, in any case, I hope no one is scandalized here, but this is the truth. So what I want to say as a result of this is, if you're going to read The Story of a Soul, and I hope you do, and if you read it, to read it again, make sure that you're reading a translation based on the original manuscripts. We have several autobiographies in English, not just in English there, but this one is the only one by Jean Clark that is really based on the original manuscript. We have also, of course, the French ones are there too. So the critical edition, with all of her other writings, is only in French. I don't think all of it's even been translated into English based on the original. This came out in 1998. And then Dr. Gozia called my attention to the fact that we also have a concordance to her works called Les Mots de Sainte-Thérèse de l'Enfant Jésus. That was published in 1996. So this means for a serious research, you know, what she said, the words she used and everything, there's a concordance that you can use to find that. Now, in order to see how she got to her little way, La Petite Voix, it's helpful to know something about the times that she lived in, because in many ways, her little way is a reaction against them, and a strong reaction against those times. Now, I know a great deal about this period, not because I'm a particularly a historian of the 19th century, but because I've read practically all of the works of the greatest of the Norman authors of the 19th century, Guy de Maupassant, whose works could be read as a devastating critique of that society. And he lived exactly at the same time as Thérèse. She was not, by the way, a child of the sunny south of France or of gay Paris. The landscape of Normandy is certainly beautiful and very green because it rains there a lot. But there isn't much sunshine total in the whole year. In fact, I would be willing to say that there is less sunshine there than there is in Ghana. So one of the effects of this beautiful landscape and so on, is that depression was not uncommon among the people. This is normal. This is one of the reasons why the further south you get, the more light you get. Generally, this has an effect on the person. So it was a time of economic growth in Normandy, and her family, the Martin family, shared in that prosperity, but it also shared in the attitudes of the time. Her family was a typical bourgeois family that prospered by working hard. And we shouldn't forget that both her parents worked full-time. They had servants to take care of the children. There was a certain work ethic, a certain appreciation of achievements and merits that left its mark on Thérèse, because it was also the way they thought a religious should be, or someone who was about to become holy. Now, later on in Thérèse's writings, she'll criticize this work ethic and sees it in the category of a type of Pharisaism. But it was common to her time. And in Normandy itself, it was connected with a type of perfectionism. In other words, you can have a work ethic, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a perfectionist. In Normandy, it seemed to be that way. And I would say this, any place that's known for the fine lace that her mother made and so on, demands perfectionism. To create the type of lace work that was done in Alençon requires for a piece of lace, a 1 euro coin requires 16 hours of work. So you've got to be a real perfectionist to do that. And, of course, then work was overvalued. And somehow you see this reaction even in this first quote that I got from von Balthasar's book and unfortunately cannot locate. Jesus does not command great deeds, but only gratitude and self-surrender. And then she quotes scripture, "I will not take the he-goats from out of the flocks, for all the beasts of the forest are mine. Shall I eat the flesh of bullocks, or shall I drink the blood of goats? Offer to God the sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving." That is all Jesus asks of us. He has no need of our works, but only of our love. That's repeated for some reason on the page afterwards. But there's a couple of other quotes that also tells you how she's reacting to that ethic of her time. "Sanctity does not consist in performing such and such acts. It means being ready at heart to become small and humble in the arms of God, acknowledging our own weaknesses and trusting in his fatherly goodness to the point of audacity." Or, right after that, "I know that certain spiritual directors advise us to count our virtuous acts in order to advance in perfection. But my spiritual director, Jesus, does not teach me to count my acts. He teaches me to do it all for love." The quote after that, "The principal plenary indulgence, and one which everyone may obtain without the customary conditions, is the indulgence of charity, which covers a multitude of sins." You'd have to remember that that all of the prayer books until roughly before the Second Vatican Council always gave you the number of days that you saved in purgatory. So this was the popular understanding, so it would be 100 days or something like this. And basically, it was easy to have this mentality, "I'm only going to do the prayers where you get, you know, a half a year or something like this. I'm not going to do the other ones. After all, it's a waste. We're just saying a Hail Mary, you only get 50 days. That's not enough." Now that may sound a bit crude, but I can tell you that's how people thought, and I knew some of them, and I didn't live at the time of St. Therese. So there is a reaction to that. As a child, Therese was trained to collect merit. Her sister, Marie, told her to do so, and this is Therese speaking here. I can still hear you saying to me, look at the shopkeepers, how much trouble they give themselves to make money, whereas we can amass treasure for heaven without giving ourselves so much trouble. All we have to do is to gather diamonds with a rake. And off I went, my heart filled with joy, overflowing with good resolutions. So she was part of that mentality, and her later development of La Petite Voix is really a reaction against that. Another characteristic of Catholic society, and here I would say not just in Normandy, but in all of France, was a tendency towards Jansenism. The Jansenist theology having its roots in the 17th century, much of the time concerned with predestination, in any case, always with sort of a pessimistic view of humanity and very rigorous moral principles. So hell was a very, very popular subject. So even, she writes, the first chaplain who came in, or was there actually, I think, when she entered Carmel, this was his favorite topic. And you can see these poor sisters here, the priestess, the pains of hell, and these poor sisters say, what did I do wrong? And so you have something like that she's also, to some extent, reacting to. The world was filled with temptations to be avoided on the way to heaven. And you sisters better behave yourself because you may end up going to the other place. So this is the type of thing that was common. I must say, in my opinion, Jansenism died out very slowly in France. When I was a young seminarian, we used to laugh at some of the practices at the Archdiocesan Seminary of Paris in Issy. I'm not going to tell you that I should tell my seminarians first. But being aware of the occasions of sin is good, no question about it, and avoiding them is good. But somehow, what was always lacking, or is lacking, in Jansenism was a proper concept of God's divine mercy. Characteristic of this time, of the Catholicism over time, was a very strong emphasis on authority and the consequence of a fear of free expression. You know, if the person in authority said something, you didn't question it. You just, you know, went along with it, even if you disagreed. And certainly a real fear of expressing feelings. That was quite characteristic. Marriage, for example, was clearly a second-rate choice. And you will recall that both her parents, Celia and Louis, wanted to enter religious life, and when they married, they intended to live like Joseph and Mary. The priest came along and talked them out of it, and they had 9 children, 5 of them lived. So, and we have to be very grateful, because if he didn't talk them out of it, we wouldn't have had St. Therese. In any case, none of her sisters aspired to get married. And it's kind of a wonder that exactly her theology, the theology and spirituality of St. Therese, speaks so powerfully to married couples today, also to single people, but very, very much to married couples. The very young Therese was by no means the angelic child about which parents often dream or hope for, but seldom get. A few years ago, I pointed out in a sermon that she had temper fits, perhaps as a result of her being a bit spoiled by her older sisters who loved her dearly and by her father. But during the process of her beatification, we read the following from a letter of her mother, who you will recall died of breast cancer when Therese was 4 and a half. This is from her mother. I have to slap this poor baby who gets into frightening furies when she cannot have her own way. She rolls about on the ground as if all were lost. She is a very high-strung child. To those of you who are parents, I say, I hope you take consolation at these words. At the age of 22, Therese, who was then a Carmelite, admitted, I quote, I was far from being a perfect little girl. With the death of her mother, Therese, though not very well behaved, but still a happy child, became timid and fearful, and a child who cried all the time. And maybe some of your parents will also know that there are some children you look at and they start to cry, and they wouldn't be able to tell you why they do it anyway, but this is the way, and that's the way she was. This shock of losing her mother at that formative age is very important for her whole development. Now, I'd have to be honest in saying her sister, especially Agnes, was wonderful to her and was like a substitute in many ways, a surrogate mother. But the truth is a mother, and she always remained a big sister, as much as she loved her and all the things that she did. Therese did well in some of the subjects at the school that was run by the Benedictine nuns. She had, after all, a superlative memory, and she was also highly intelligent. And one of the priests at this Benedictine school called her my little doctor of the church. My little doctor of the church. Now, you could say, well, that was certainly prophetic. It's a little more than prophetic because, as I said this morning, there weren't any women doctors of the church until 1970. Who would get such a thought in your own mind? So the first two were St. Teresa of Avila and St. Catherine of Siena. The third one was then St. Therese de Lisieux. Now, she didn't like some of the aspects of the school that she had entered. She was homeschooled, actually, until she was 8 and a half. And then she left to be tutored 5 years later. So in terms of formal school, she was there for 5 years. This period, after the death of her mother, until her entrance into religious life, was certainly the most difficult in her life. Pauline, Mother Agnes, was a surrogate mother, but Pauline entered Carmel when Therese was 9, setting off another crisis in her life. That is, her second mother then leaves and goes into Carmel. And this contributed to the depression she experienced at the age of 10, although some refer to it as a nervous breakdown. In any case, she thrashed in her bed, banged her head against the bedpost, and she had hallucinations. This improved considerably, as we know from the incident of gazing at a statue of the Blessed Mother and her seeing the Blessed Mother smile at her. This, I know a lot of people say, oh, that's just pious and so forth, but it does seem to have done something to her and to get her out of this depression. Unfortunately, a year later, she developed the scrupulosity as an obsessive compulsive neurosis. This was what was diagnosed at the time. Being scrupulous alone doesn't necessarily make you mentally ill. It means you're a very sensitive person. But we'd have to say that the diagnosis at the time, whether it was right or wrong, she had certainly the symptoms of it. Many people say she was, during this first stage of the dark night of the soul, she was obsessed by sexual temptations and images, which, by the way, are characteristic of someone who suffers from neurotic scrupulosity. But the truth is, we don't know. The taboos of the time would not have allowed her to speak to anyone about such things except for her own confessor, and he certainly was not going to tell. In any case, her famous conversion experience on Christmas Eve of 1886 put an end to that illness as well. That's what I really believe, that there were no effective therapies against scrupulosity, neurotic scrupulosity at the time. In fact, until recent time, there was very little you could do about it. But I personally feel that she was genuinely healed at the time, and that all of what we read about the dark nights of the soul afterwards were spiritual and not psychological experiences. That doesn't mean that she was never scrupulous again, but not scrupulous in a very unhealthy way. She was a very sensitive soul. The story of her entering Carmel at a very early age and receiving the Pope's blessing to do so, if it's God's will. The Pope Leo XIII was very careful with what he said. This is well known to you. And she makes it very clear that she entered the Carmel to become a saint. This is repeated several times. Why did she want to go there? Because she wanted to become a saint. And that's what she felt God wanted her to do. And that's why she was so determined to go there. That was her goal. Now, she wasn't satisfied with Pope Leo XIII's answer. And what did she do? She showed some of the obstinacy that she exhibited as a very young child. She would not leave the audience room. She knelt on the floor and clung to the slippers of the Holy Father. So the Swiss guards had to carry her out. So, you know, it's kind of, I think it's a nice story, actually. It's true, by the way. Now, the trip to Italy with her father, which of course ended up, was it her father and Celine, opened up a world to her that gave images for her writings. Among them, for example, an elevator, this wonderful thing of God sort of like taking you in an elevator up to heaven instead of having to climb up the steps, which she was incapable of doing. Now, how would she know that? They certainly didn't have an elevator in the Carmel where she was living. I don't know if they needed it. I've been there, but yeah, probably they have one today. But anyway, they didn't then. And so she had been in these large, nice hotels in Rome, and not just Rome, Milan, and the other places that they went on this trip, but she was quite familiar with this sort of new invention, and therefore could use it in her writings. There's a number of other things that came from this trip. It sort of broadened her vision, what she wouldn't have had if she had just gone directly into Carmel. At this point, I want to back up a bit and say something that was essential to understanding the way that she thought, and especially to understanding her little way. And it also will tell you why some people find this little way difficult. Thérèse had a wonderful, warm relationship to her father. Now, you could say he was a saint. At this point, of course, he's declared blessed, but we would assume that at some point in time he'll be canonized. But nonetheless, sanctity is not always connected with a warmth of character. It doesn't always go with it, unfortunate, but that's the way it is. But throughout all of these crises and sicknesses, Thérèse had the comfort of knowing that her father was always there for her. You can't imagine how important that was for her to know. So that all of this contributed to her image of God the Father as one you could absolutely trust and one that you could go to at all times, because that's the way her father was. We can't ignore that. On the other hand, for people who have not had a good relationship to their father from early on, or perhaps with a substitute if the father had died, having that simple trust in God that Thérèse had is very difficult. I don't say it's impossible. I don't say it's nothing is impossible. But it is very difficult. So this is an important part of her gift to us, the gift, first of all, that she received from having such a wonderful father. But what happened shortly after she entered Carmel? Her dearly beloved's father went insane. He had to be disarmed from a loaded pistol that nobody knew what he was going to do, what was there. And though his condition seemed to improve enough so that he was able to be present at the taking of her habit, or receiving of the habit, a few months afterwards, and this was a great joy for Thérèse, it then severely deteriorated with the fact that he then spent 3 years in an insane asylum. And I choose that word quite deliberately, because that's what they were then. They weren't at all nice psychiatric wards with all that you find today. If you ever take a tour of the old Allgemeine Krankenhaus in Vienna, you can see where they put insane people, and it is kind of frightening. So he was there for 3 years. And you have to remember the 19th century mental illness was a great, great disgrace to a family. Thérèse perhaps felt it a little bit less because she was already in the convent. She didn't have the talking with all of the people. Her sisters must have had an awful time dealing with that. But the worst thing for Thérèse was what the doctors said, the reason that he went insane. What did they say? This was their diagnosis. Thérèse, the apple of her father's eye, went into the convent, and that triggered off his mental illness. She had to live with that. She had to live with that. And yet, it's interesting that she says that these 3 years of knowing that her father was in an insane asylum in another town in Caen, and being there were some of the richest spiritual experiences in her life. And if you see her writings and you can do a little bit of dating, you'll see that what happens is that she deepens her relationship with the second person of the Blessed Trinity, of Jesus Christ. Now, she had, of course, in her title, the Holy Face. So, and this was a popular devotion in the 19th century, a devotion to the Holy Face, sometimes associated with the veil of Saint Veronica. And I would say it's somewhat akin to the devotion many people have today to the Shroud of Turin. But in the 19th century, it was then this Holy Face of Jesus. And so this new relationship that brought her to understand the sufferings of Jesus Christ. It would be very false to say she had no relationship to Jesus Christ before and only to God the Father. But nonetheless, this because of her own suffering, she began to understand the sufferings of Jesus Christ and to appropriate that. But it was a time of great aridity and suffering on her part. I don't want to underestimate that. The suffering that she had, by the way, had very little to do with her sisters. Now, the sisters in the convent, some of who were, of course, her own blessed sisters. The famous story that's also in the Divina about her getting splashed regularly by a sister as she was washing and things like this shouldn't be attributed to the ill will of that particular sister, and I don't think she does. You have to remember Thérèse and her sisters were part of the bourgeoisie of the time. They were, fairly well off. They were well educated, and they had manners. Most of the sisters, except for the superior, Mother Mary de Gonzague, who was from an aristocratic family, most of them were very poor. They were from very poor families, without much of an upbringing. And so you might say, these were the sort of sisters who would slurp their soup, and you get annoyed there because your mother told you not to do that. This is the type of thing that you have to remember that was going on there. Mother Marie was a bit authoritarian, to say the least, but it has to be said of her that she deeply loved Sister Thérèse and sensed right from the beginning, the first time she met her before she even went into convent, that Thérèse was going to be more than just another good sister. And for her part, must one say that Thérèse did not stand out from the other sisters by doing, say, the best work. Her novice mistress mentioned that she did everything, but she was a bit slow. She was a bit slow. She could have, done something a little bit faster than she was doing. Now, I love the little story that's told near the end of her life. Thérèse herself tells it. When she was lying on her sick bed, and there were two sisters standing outside who they thought she was, sleeping and so on. She was taking sometimes pain relievers and things like this, and it seemed as if that was the case there. So they were talking. Now, at that time, it was customary when a sister died not only to send out a notice to the other Carmels about that the sister had died asking for her prayers, which is still done today, but also it was customary to write something about the sister, what she had contributed to the Carmel. So it could be something like she spent long nights in prayer, she was the best cook we had with all the simple ingredients. There's all sorts of possibilities. And these two sisters, talking to each other, said, "What are we going to write about her? What are we going to write about her?" Of course, they didn't know the relationship maybe of what was going to happen to her writings and things like this, but she was so unremarkable. And this gave Saint Thérèse and her sickbed great joy, because this is what she actually wanted. She wanted not to be distinguished by doing work better than anyone else. She wanted to be distinguished by the love with which she did things, but doing the simplest things and not standing out. And so she became holy by doing her duties as a sister, but not doing anything extraordinary, so that she'd say, "Oh, sister, we've never had such beautiful blossoms, flowers in the chapel as we have today." This was not the case. The proximate story of how the little way was developed is connected with the entrance of her sister Céline in the Carmel after the death of their beloved father. Céline brought with her her camera. I've already said that earlier, all the developing equipment. This is kind of surprising, you know, if you think of Carmel, that this was, at that time, you have to say a camera really was a luxury. Today, I'm sure they would have all of those things. But at that time, bringing this in, but there was no objection to that whatsoever. But what Céline brought with her that was more important than the camera in the end, she brought a notebook filled with quotes from the Old Testament. She brought a notebook filled. And you have to remember, the young sisters at the time had no access to the Old Testament at all. It wasn't allowed. In fact, there were convents that until the Second Vatican Councils, the sisters were not supposed to read the Old Testament. And this had nothing to do with the violent scenes of capturing the land, but with a passage that might be perceived as a temptation for some of the sisters. So this was the attitude that many convents had at the time, including there of Carmel. But now she had this book of selected passages. And among the many treasures of sacred scripture that Céline brought, you'll see what then led her to the development, to her little way. So this is actually in the first quote from manuscript C, from chapter 10, especially the second paragraph. Well, it says here, maybe probably wouldn't hurt to look at all of it since it's a very important passage. "You know, Mother, I've always wanted to be a saint. Alas, I have always noticed that when I compared myself to the saints, there is between them and me the same difference that exists between a mountain whose summit is lost in the clouds and the obscure grain of sand trampled underneath by passers-by. Instead of becoming discouraged, I said to myself, God cannot inspire unrealizable desires. I can then, in spite of my littleness, aspire to holiness. It is impossible for me to grow up, and so I must bear with myself, such as I am, with all my imperfections. But I want to seek out a means of going to heaven by a little way, a way that is very straight, very short, and totally new. We are living now in an age of inventions, and we no longer have to take the trouble of climbing stairs, for in the homes of the rich, an elevator has replaced these very successfully. I wanted to find an elevator which would raise me to Jesus, for I am too small to climb the rough stairway of perfection. I searched then in the scriptures for some signs of this elevator, the object of my desires, and I read these words coming from the mouth of eternal wisdom. Whoever is a little one, let him come to me. Proverbs 9:4. That's, of course, based on the translation of the French. You could argue whether the Hebrew says that exactly, but it doesn't matter. It's an inspired text. And so I succeeded. I felt I had found what I was looking for. But wanting to know, oh my God, what you would do to the very little one who answered your call, I continued my search." So she's looking through this notebook now. "And this is what I discovered. As one whom a mother caresses, so I will comfort you. You shall be carried on the breast, and upon the knees they shall caress you." So from Isaiah 66:12-13. "And never did words more tender and more melodious come to give joy to my soul. The elevator which must raise me to heaven in your arms, O Jesus. And for this I had no need to grow up, but rather I had to remain little and become this more and more." So it shows, you know, just you'd say it was an accident that Céline brought this notebook. But you see how God works. All of this was part of God's plan. And then, of course, especially in her letters, you know, she had correspondence with priests and two seminarians. And these, you could see her trying to explain that more and more, and explaining it to her sisters as well. Even a couple of the plays you know, our explanations of this little way. So I think that's also to keep in mind and to show how God works. Many of us have understood her little way as her understanding of that a follower of Christ must seek holiness in the ordinary and in the everyday. So if you want to be a follower, then you seek holiness in the ordinary and the everyday, not necessarily in anything extraordinary. And this is a correct understanding. Doing what you're supposed to be doing at the time is what leads to holiness. If Thérèse had decided to go to the chapel and pray instead of, let's say, do the dishes, she would not have been doing God's will, and she would not have been growing in holiness. She was supposed to be doing the dishes. After that, I suppose she could go to the chapel and pray. But we don't have very many memories of her that we do, for example, of the great Saint Teresa, of going into ecstasy and having to be pulled down and things like this. Maybe these things happen, but they don't seem to be recorded. So in other words, to see that, seeking holiness in the ordinary and the everyday, the things that people say, well, you're supposed to do that anyway. You should take out the garbage. Okay, take out the garbage. So like this. Now this means concretely for you students, you have to make this practical, that if you're supposed to be studying Greek, I always use Greek as an example because some people, I can't imagine why, don't like it. But anyway, if you're supposed to be studying Greek and instead go to the chapel to pray, you're not doing God's will. That's right. And you're not going to grow in holiness. I'm sorry to be so blunt in using it, but it's true. Now, this little way rests on two foundations. First of all, is trust in God's mercy and his willingness to forgive. And over the years, Therese reflects on the fact that God had become a child. So she had a particular understanding of the incarnation. And for her, she couldn't understand what she perceived, and I think quite correctly, as the unhealthy fear of God of her time, the God of justice that you have to fear. Because she said, if God became a child, why do you have to worry about that? All of this with the rigorism and the Jansenism of the time. Once again, of course, her relationship to her father contributed to this healthy concept. And another point that would be part of the foundation of the little way was that she could never be perfect if following the Lord meant that she could avoid all faults and sins. And she knew very well, because of her own experience, that it was all God's grace that protected her from whatever it was, or that also protected her from having this false concept of God. Now here I've often wondered what would have happened if Thérèse had been living at the time of the Reformation. Because I would maintain that her radical understanding of grace and works was more orthodox and more accurate than most of the theologians, Catholic and Protestant, of her time. I know it's kind of a scandalous thing to say, but I really mean that, that she had such an understanding, such a perfect understanding of grace and works, that you wonder why. Well, I wouldn't say nobody understood it before, but it would have helped at the time in the Reformation. And that's also, by the way, I think she richly deserves the title of Doctor of the Faith, if you are Doctor of the Church. There's, by the way, a wonderful book on her, the relationship between grace and works, and what she wrote and what's written about her, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which is also in our library. That's this one here, by Sylvain Destrampe, Thérèse de Lisieux, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It goes very thoroughly and shows the parallels, someone writing in the 20th century and then her writing in the 19th century on the whole subject of grace and works. I'd also like to emphasize another characteristic, a characteristic of our times. It was also characteristic of Saint Therese and her writings. And that is, I've said it in a way before, but it's an understanding of divine mercy. She had an understanding of divine mercy at a time when very few people could have related to it, certainly not in the way you would understand today. In the 19th century, and perhaps a little after that, it was customary in many convents for the sisters to offer themselves as sacrificial victims to God's divine justice. That's how it was expressed in English. Sacrifice, your sacrificial victim to God's justice, may God's justice be done, and so on and so forth. Therese refused to do that. She wrote up for herself and Celine an act of oblation in which the two of them, on June 11, 1895, offered themselves as sacrificial offerings to God's divine mercy. And in this act of oblation, the two sisters read together the following. If through weakness I should chance to fall, may a glance from your eyes straightway cleanse my soul and consume all my imperfections as fire transform all things into itself. And she wrote further, in the evening of this life, I shall appear before you with empty hands, for I do not ask you, Lord, to count my works. The empty hands then became actually the title of one of the best biographies of Saint Therese. That's the title in English. It actually was done by the Dutch Carmelite, Conan de Mater. I have the French, but there's editions of the English and the German in our library. I would recommend it very highly. It's true that some conclusions he reaches that he might not reach if he had seen the original text, but in general, it's a very inspiring biography of Saint Therese. So, the empty hands, which is what, of course, she said here during her oblation. Now, there'll always be more, as I said at the beginning, that can be said about our patroness, Saint Therese, and the aspect of love as part of the little way. So that, I would say, requires a talk in itself. I've neglected it, but it's not possible to say everything. Therese's manuscript, that is manuscript C, which is what ends her autobiography, it ends rather abruptly because she was too weak to write anymore. But I want to end with her words as they are during the closing days of her life. I repeat, filled with confidence, the publican's humble prayer. Most of all, I imitate the conduct of Magdalene. Her astonishing, or rather her loving audacity, which charms the heart of Jesus, also attracts my own. Yes, I feel it. Even if I had on my conscience all the sins that could be committed, I would go, my heart broken with sorrow, and throw myself into Jesus' arms. For I know how much he loves the prodigal child who returns to him. It is not because God, in his anticipating mercy, has reserved my soul for mortal sin that I'll go to him. I go to him with confidence and love. May all of us also always go to the Lord with confidence and love.